Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Failing Up. Of course, I'm Guy and Eden.
Hi.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, you know, we didn't correct Alex. You called me Eden.
He did?
Fine. Yeah. Huh.
I am so glad I heard that out loud before I had to start.
I went on a date once and he said, "Hello, Eden." And I was like, "How did you know how to say my name correctly?" And they were like, "I listened to your podcast."
That's actually very smart, I think. Don't you like a guy who does a little
research? To be fair, you were totally creeped out when he said that. Yeah.
Yeah,
really?
I was totally creeped out. But I shouldn't be, because I stalk people too.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that the point of dating online, is like being able to check
and
people
then
out
that,
first?
Yeah. And then that conversation led to me to say that to another person I ended up dating. And then nothing. I was like, yeah, this one guy I went on a date with, like, said my name correctly, unlike you. And then he felt bad.
I would think it would be like, have the courtesy to mispronounce my name the first time.
Listen to my podcast. What's your fucking problem?
But I'm like the asshole that's like, my name isn't spelled, it's spelled like this, but pronounced like this.
Right.
My name is Regina, pronounced Regina.
Right.
Like, no.
So it's not people's fault. You don't blame them.
I don't blame them. I will answer to both. Paul Feig.
You'll answer to Regina?
Yes.
That's
and vagina.
That's a choice. That's a choice.
Paul Feig calls me Eden. He's called me Eden for years, and he's Paul Feig, so I'm not going to correct him.
Of course
call
not.
Him Paul Feig.
Yeah, I should, huh?
Yeah. Hey, Mr. Feig.
No, I call him Paul Feig, which is better.
But he doesn't realize. He's not doing it to, like, mess with you.
No, he's totally not. I just don't have the balls or the vagina to do it.
Yeah, I guess not. Well, now, in case he listens.
Okay. He's got better things to do.
Let's introduce our guests.
Eddie. Should I not have spoken before this?
No, you should.
Okay.
Do you want to introduce
You can
our
introduce.
Guest? He's a writer, a producer, a showrunner, and he was also one of the somebody in charge of casting for one of my favorite movies, I believe. And he's not the backup goalie for the St. Louis Blues. His name, please welcome Ben Wexler.
Hi. Was there any confusion as to whether I was the backup goalie?
I always do my research.
Okay.
And, you know, at one point, the backup goalie for the St. Louis Blues is apparently some regular dude. And there was an article about him named Ben Wexler. Yeah.
Wow. Is he Jewish?
I don't know. Probably.
Great Jewish goalies.
That's why he's the backup. We can add him to
the Great Jewish goalies, chapters 1 through 26.
Yeah, exactly.
Ben Wexler.
And so I was like, you know, and I said it as a joke. Obviously, I knew. I'm not. I did look at the picture just in case.
It's never a bad idea.
No picture. So, again, he's just like some regular dude that they don't really use.
I should have worn a goalie mask tonight. That would have been amazing.
And a great start for a horror movie.
Yeah.
I would have been freaked out. So
that's cool.
I did just mention one of my favorite movies of all time is Forrest Gump. And so you did casting for Forrest
Gump? That was my first job in Hollywood.
How does that happen?
Crazy. Like, we're throwing us into the deep end.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. No, I how does it happen? I basically had a friend of a friend just out of college who said, he put me in touch with her. She was working for a producer named Wendy Feinerman, who was one of the producers on Forrest Gump. Mm-hmm. And they needed an intern in the casting department. And on the same week, I started a part-time gig, like filing stuff at a tiny little agency just to make money. And the internship on first of all, like, they're like, you go here, it's called Forrest Gump. And I was like, I guess that's the name of the company or something, because that can't possibly. Yeah, I was like, it sounds like a law firm kind of, you know,
sure.
Like it truly didn't. Those words didn't mean anything.
Right, of course.
Those two words together didn't mean anything. So I assumed it was like. And then when I found out it was the title of a movie starring Tom Hanks and directed by Robert Zemeckis, I'm like, oh, this is a cool job. You know, I liked it so much more than the paying gig that I was doing in the morning that I worked extra hard on the internship and literally reorganized all of their. This is back when, like, casting offices got physical submissions.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like actual headshots.
I worked in one of those.
Sure. No, I mean, like, huge manila envelopes stacked
headshots.
Floor to ceiling in this office that nobody had time to organize. And I organized all of it.
Wow.
Like, everything.
Hey, I got a cabinet. Do you want to start?
No, literally. And then by the end of the first week, they were like, if we don't pay this guy, we're not going to be able to find anything. You know, it was like, I was the only person who knew where. So by the second week I was getting paid, and then I quit the job that I hated. And that was a great job. And I worked on it for like 18 months, because I went from casting to locations to set PA to helping them out like with the Oscar part. You know, it was like, it was amazing. It was a great, great, great job.
So now I will back up a young Ben Wexler. What is he? What does he want to be when he grows up? Is it writing?
I think by the time I got out of college, I knew I wanted to write. I'd started a humor magazine at UCLA, and I was a columnist at the Daily Bruin at UCLA and a viewpoint editor. So I had a taste of like what it was to write and to have people read, you know, your funny stuff,
right,
and like it.
And the satisfaction that you get from people.
And, yeah.
Who were your influences? Was it like a Mad Magazine? Was it TV, movies?
Oh boy. I mean, probably at the time, my influences in a non-sexual way were Woody Allen. In a very sexual way was Steve Martin.
Okay.
You know, Billy Crystal was,
So it was comedians.
And also, I think, if you had asked me probably when I was 21, what would you most aspire to, like on your best day, what do you think you might be able to be capable of? It would be like a movie like Broadcast News that James L. Brooks wrote and directed, you know, like a movie like that, which was smart and funny and poignant and just great and about real characters. That was, I'd say, and that's kind of, on some level, that still kind of drives me in terms of what my ambition creatively is.
And where'd you grow up?
Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. Evanston. And
what brought you out here?
UCLA.
UCLA. It was UCLA.
Yeah, okay. I got into a few schools, and it basically came down. It was honestly one of the smartest decisions I ever made in my life, because I don't know if I would have had the guts to come out to LA when I was 21. But at 17, when you got to go to college anyway, it was just like, get me. And I really wanted to leave and go as far away from home as I could. So that's what I did.
Okay.
It was great.
Not a fan of Chicago?
I'm a huge fan of Chicago, but it was like,
I mean, other than the White Sox.
I'm a huge fan of Chicago. I love going back home.
Yeah.
I am, as you mentioned, a White Sox fan. But like I knew on some level I wanted to wind up in LA. And so this was going to be the easiest sort of, in some way, it was like the lowest barrier to entry. It's like you're in college, and then you kind of meet people and you know what the streets look like, and you're just less intimidated by the time it's graduation time.
Right.
And you're already there. And then that led to Forrest Gump. And then you're kind of working in showbiz.
That's amazing. Actually. I mean,
it was crazy.
So that was the impetus, that just from there on out, you were working in the industry
one way or another. I was doing assistant jobs for a long time and writing specs. Yeah.
Okay. So what do you remember what your first job was from after Forrest Gump? And let me just ask you, when that happened, I mean, it's such a huge movie. Is it like, oh, I'm going to be even bigger than I am?
Or No.
You didn't have delusions of grandeur?
Well, you're a casting assistant. I mean, there's literally even like, so, and you want to be a writer. So that's not, there's no path from like, if you do a good enough job as a casting.
Right.
If you do a good enough job as a casting assistant, you become a casting director.
Yeah.
I think it does teach you something. Like, because I think any aspect of working in the industry, no matter what you do, because like I was a set PA when I was 16 because I'm from LA.
Oh, wow.
So I couldn't escape.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up like, well, my parents were met at UCLA. They were they went to grad school there. So when I was born, they lived around Westwood, and then we moved to like Miracle Mile-ish area by the WGA. And I PA'd when I was 16 and like 15 on like movie sets for no pay. Just I wanted to see what it was like.
Right.
And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to be an actress, but I wasn't sure. And just like getting to know like, oh, this is what a unit production manager does. This is what assistant director does. This is what a cinematographer does. Like all that stuff, I think, led me to understand, oh, the writing process.
Because
it's like when you write a really good script, it's like you're thinking, oh, I want the makeup people to get excited about it. I want the actors to want to make it.
Right.
I want the casting people to be like, I got someone. It's like, so you have to really take into consideration all those things. And I think being any kind of assistant, any sort of.
Oh, yeah. Helps. No, you have to. I mean, if you want to work in Hollywood, you have to get a job in Hollywood doing whatever.
Something.
You have to. I mean, I think it's like the. Not that anybody's asking advice, but like when somebody does, it's always just like, if you don't live in LA, move to LA. And there is, I think, and in some ways I envy you for having grown up here. Cause I think from Chicago, it's like the idea of making it in Hollywood is literally thought of as impossible. Like all I heard growing up is like, nobody, it just doesn't. It would be like being a Major League Baseball player.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like
I'm from New Jersey, so I have that same
concept. It just doesn't. You don't know anybody who went to Hollywood. And if you do, you don't know anybody who had success. And so it's like a long process of getting over intimidation.
Yeah, but with me, I felt this pressure like, oh, you're from LA and you're not successful in Hollywood?
Right.
Like, why? And like, how is your... Don't you have like an uncle or something that can get you a job? I'm like, No, my parents did not want me to work in Hollywood. Right. They were Jews that were like, please go to medical school.
Right.
But I think there's something to what Ben's saying in that, like just the mystique.
Yeah.
It's so intimidating when you get here.
You're like, I couldn't possibly.
And by the way, it's still intimidating. It never stops.
Is it?
Me. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. It's intimidating.
Totally.
I mean, you know, you've been on, you've written for some really humongous shows. Like, isn't there at some point in your life and you're like, okay. I don't have to worry too much about this.
You get a better sense of you're good at this or, mm-hmm. you know, that you know what you're doing. And that I think probably the biggest fear overcoming thing is you kind of realize like, oh, I'm probably not going to like get hit in the brain with a pipe tomorrow and stop being who I am. And that's mostly, you know, a lot of being good at writing is just sort of seeing the world through the eyes that you see it through and being able to put in the work. And, you know, I mean, I'd say every time you're still a little bit like, oh, am I going to have to work that hard this time too? But you totally do.
Yeah.
You know, but
it's funny though. Cause you just said like, that's what writers worry about, getting hit in the head with a pipe. Cause like a piano player worries about in the brain. Yeah. Piano player worries about their hands, you know,
that's a thing.
I don't even know what I worry about, but definitely not. I've never thought about, oh my God.
My dad got sick, he had brain cancer and he got stupid real fast. Oh, and man. I was like, I can't get this disease because this is my career. If I can't think, if I don't remember what I like, if I don't remember, if I can't think of ideas, I'm like out of a job.
That's
like,
true.
And I have a lot of, I think that's why I go to a therapist because I need like my brain needs to like get some like, it needs exercise and TLC because this is what I feel like that's like a piano player has his hands mm-hmm. as a writer. I think it's my brain. Huh. Yeah. And I guess hands too. But now there's like, you can do voice to text and all that shit.
Sure. So. Look what happened to Steve. Did you see they actually have a new thing? It's not out. It's just created, but it's like this jawbone thing that goes right across your jawbone.
That could give you brain cancer.
And you think up stuff and it does but shit.
Wait, seriously?
I'm 100% serious.
No, you're not.
Like it has to train a little bit to know like your waves, but you just put it over your ear and across your jaw.
Think of all the porn.
You can like, I was going to say, you can look at your phone and just be like, you know, like think scroll up and it scrolls up or like. You can write things just with your brain.
I'm kind of writing a sci-fi movie about that very
thing.
But it's not a jaw thing. It's like a brain implant thing. But I probably shouldn't have said that on your podcast.
No.
You know.
We can always cut it
28
out.
Jewish writers are going to steal it.
You hear the typewriters going right
28
now.
Jewish writers aren't listening to podcasts, especially one, a Jewish woman. So.
Do you ever feel like somebody has stolen your words or your work? Or like, you know what I'm saying? Like even on Twitter, you know, that's a rampant thing where people will take other people's tweets and you're like, that was my...
Like the fat Jewish?
Oh, no. 100% I got a script word for word stolen when I was just starting out. Like that.
Register it or something?
What's that?
Did you not register
it? Well, no. What it was this is back in the days when you would write a spec.
Right.
You would write like a Friends
spec. You still have
spec.
To write. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, you would write like you would literally write like an episode of Friends.
Right.
So my episode of Friends, and this is, by the way, this is the script that was like my seventh or eighth spec script that finally got me like.
It's not the one where they all get AIDS, is it?
No, it's not that one. Oh, God, how I wish I had written that one. No, no, but like, this is the one that got me all
the
of
jobs.
My first jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I essentially accept the offer to go on my first ever job as a TV staff writer. And it's Memorial Day weekend. It's about to, like, it's Friday before Memorial Day weekend. And I get a call and they're like, little problem. The writer's assistant on the show logged two scripts called The One with the Mugger, right? You know, like same title, everything. So he looked at them. I was probably like back in the days again when there was physical paper,
right?
And the results were troubling because every word on every page was exactly the same. I mean, like they lived.
That's even fishier.
I got a copy of it maybe weeks after the fact, and they changed four lines. They retyped it.
Oh my gosh.
It was a different font.
Yeah.
Font?
Literally that's... a different font.
You're allowed.
I was like, no, because there's a font that you use and they used the wrong font. They changed it from the right font to the and all
that's retarded.
All four changes they made were to punch down jokes that they didn't get. So
that's the worst kind of
it was crazy.
How
so,
does
yes,
somebody
that
get that? I mean, I guess you'd sent it out and somebody stole it off the desk
I actually sort of reconstructed the path through which it got from me to the guy.
And do you know who that person, like,
yeah,
you know that
person? Yeah, yeah.
Did you confront them?
No, I never got to.
Really?
I never got to.
What do you want to say to him?
Well, he's I mean, listening. You know what?
Say his name.
My roommate at the time was a guy named Matt Nix, who's like since gone on to become a huge showrunner and is still a great friend of mine. And I remember him, I don't know if it was about this particular incident, mm-hmm. but I remember when we were roommates and he had just read a book and the advice in the book was, don't get mad, don't get even, get ahead. And it was like badass. It was like, yeah, get ahead.
Yeah.
And so honestly, I was able to like, at, you know, there were a few months of like wanting to like find this guy and like,
of course,
slash his tires or, you know, like,
that's how
you
I feel
know,
about my
put
ex.
A fist in his pie or something.
Right.
Like
confront him at least.
Yeah, and just or like punch him in the face, I guess.
Subscribe him to a bunch of emails.
Exactly.
Lists, like
exactly.
Groupon.
Yeah. It would have been Foundation. Like at the time it would have been like, you know, like hard magazine subscriptions.
Right.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like hardcore, just like
Oprah.
Yeah, tons of Oprah. Yeah, like Oprah and just hardcore porn.
Yeah.
Just those two things.
And the Christian Science Monitor.
Yeah. But, you know, there came a point where I was like, I never heard from him again. I never heard his name again. As far as I know, he has been out of the business for 2 decades.
But how do they understand that you actually wrote it and he didn't? Is there a way to prove it?
Well, ultimately, my agent, it was this crazy long story. And basically, we got a lawyer pro bono to write a cease and desist letter, which was sent to them. No, you like you can't send. They got into like the Warner Brothers writing program on
what?
This. Yeah, it was
God.
Bananas. It was crazy. It was back when like you
this
know,
is
know,
this,
like crazy. It was crazy. It was
a movie.
Ridiculous story. And they kind of they spent the first. So I spent all of Memorial Day weekend like, am I gonna fucking lose this job over this
yeah.
thing? This thing got stolen from me. Their first rejoinder was to claim that I had stolen it from them. You know, which is
right.
what you do when you're.
Of course.
Them or Donald Trump. And you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
just completely attack back. And so I was just like, okay, I'll show you every draft. I'll show you every index card that I wrote. You know, I kept everything. I kept a log of everyone I had sent it to on the date that I had sent it
That's
to them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was like it was very clear that I was going to be able to prove if it had come to some sort of like
right.
dispute. And they quickly backed down and
Good.
I got the job.
Huh. Oh, so you did get the job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah.
And what would you remember what that was for? What show?
It was a
for?
Show called Working with Fred Savage on
oh.
NBC.
Okay.
And it was actually kind of an inspired sitcom. It was probably a little bit before its time because it was like a multicam that did like cutaways and stuff. Mm. And it probably, had it come 10 years later, it would have been a single cam and it would have been like
different.
A huge hit. Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Are there,
but it went 2 years.
Are there any other shows that you think of like that you're like, oh, it just came at the wrong time. I wish.
Well, yeah. I mean.
All the time?
Like, is I think that happens all the time.
I think Freaks and Geeks was at the wrong time.
Probably.
So I got canceled so fast. It was at the time there was a lot of multicam shows and it was the first single cam on a network slot about like misfit teenagers and it got canceled real quick. But there had such a cult following and just, you know.
I didn't realize it got canceled quickly. I thought it was.
One season.
Really?
18 episodes.
You're
kidding. So good.
I know. Every
so
single
good.
One. There's not
Every
one episode.
Every single one.
That's bad. And
so good.
That's why I tell people when, you know, your show's canceled, that usually means it's good.
Yeah. Well, also, like, you're right, because at the time it was probably funnier than any drama, but more dramatic than any comedy.
Yeah.
And people just didn't know what to do with it. And now you could absolutely do that.
And
you would
think,
find a place for it.
Yeah, that's the thing. And now there's just so much TV to consume
right.
that you got to be strange and different or else you're just going to blend in.
Right.
And people, I think, got tired of the network model of, like, you know, now people hate multicams.
Right.
Like, which is weird because I have a big respect for multicam because I used to, like, as like a theater person in high school and, you know, college, I was like, that's theater. Like, multicam is theater doing in front of a live audience.
Yeah.
To write it is very difficult. Write jokes that can nail on not a single cam show is difficult to do it, you know. So I just think they just pick the wrong ones lately. Maybe that's what's going on. People don't like it as recently, but you know, back then they were like Seinfeld and Friends and all that, as you know.
Yes.
Ruled the TV at the time.
Is it easier now or harder now to be a writer? Just, you know, obviously there are more channels, which is a positive thing in a sense, but then your audience gets diluted. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? As a writer, does it not matter?
I guess it's, I mean, I guess I'm a little more focused on what I'm writing and a little less focused on where it's going to land, which may be a dumb strategy.
No, I think it's good.
You know, but so I think that the challenge probably, and in some ways it's this, you know, like they do studies where it's like when people have more choices, they get more depressed.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Because that's why everyone looks sad at the Cheesecake Factory.
That's exactly right.
They're like a novel of a menu.
That and all the bad choices that they made leading up to sitting down. In that
and there's like an escalator at the Cheesecake Factory, which is my first rule. No escalators at your restaurant.
If you can't make it up the stairs, don't go to a second floor restaurant. Exactly. We all know that. But no, so I think that the challenge of having all of those potential places where something could be right for really puts the onus on you as a writer to kind of say, okay, well, what do I really want to write? Which is actually a kind of a terrifying place to be when you think about it. Because this is like when there were three channels and it was like, is it going to be for channel 5, channel 7, or channel 2? You'd be like, you know, you kind of knew what kind of shows had a chance of being a show, and you wouldn't try to write something that different if you were trying to get something on the air.
Right.
And now we've kind of seen people break the mold left and right.
There's so many shows.
And as you say, Eden, I'm so good at pronouncing people's names that like as you say, it's people break the mold and people are expected to break the mold. Mm-hmm. And that can work really well when it works, and it can fall really flat on its face when it doesn't. So, so it's
like
scary.
Netflix now. Essentially.
Totally.
Yeah. That's the thing with Netflix. It's like, which gets me all the time worked up, because it's like when a show I wrote doesn't get picked up by Netflix or something, I'm like, okay, I had so many people believing in this. Everybody was telling me it was so good. And then I turn on Netflix and I see such a bad show. And I'm like, who believed this was a good show? How did this get made?
Yeah.
I always ask myself, how did this get made a lot? Like,
isn't there a podcast called?
There is,
yeah, okay.
But it's
yeah.
for movies. But I feel that about TV shows sometimes because there's so many on Netflix that I'm just like, these are terrible.
Yeah.
How is this, how is this a show?
And Dead Pilot Society with my friends Ben and Andrew.
Yeah,
Did you
go to their like...
I have, and it's great.
Their werewolf and...
Oh, I didn't go to that one.
Oh, okay. I was invited. I didn't go this year.
Yeah, but it's great. You know, I mean, it's like, it's cathartic almost to like have a script that didn't see the light of day. You know, you get to read it and you get to hear people laugh at it or hear people react to it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you're absolutely right. Because a lot of it does... A lot of it does feel...
Yeah, even with like Freaks and Geeks, it's like you can't have a gem and it could die just because we don't know the powers of B that, you know.
Yeah.
Does it ever get easier? Like I'm buddies with Danny Zucker, you know, and he told me like just recently he had a show go to pilot and he was like, even at this, you know, he's done so many things at this point though, it was one of those that he just really believed in and then it died on the vine and...
He's so funny.
He's like, oh, I shouldn't have let myself get.
You do it every time, though.
Okay,
every time.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Except for me, I always think it's gonna like.
Really?
I don't think anything's gonna happen.
But when you get the call with the bad news, no. But when you get the call with the bad news,
oh, the bad news, I get an email.
Okay, but when you get the email with the bad news, doesn't it hurt every time? To me, it hurts every time.
I never got this before. I was telling this on a podcast a couple weeks ago because we're talking about failure, and I was like, I got a rejection. I never got a rejection letter from Jimmy Kimmel. Not Jimmy Kimmel himself, but the people that work there. Because I submitted a packet because they asked me to submit a packet.
Right.
They literally, and I've never been asked by the showrunner to submit a packet.
Yeah. Okay.
So I thought maybe I have a good chance because like.
Sure.
They asked me to. That's never happened before.
Yeah.
And they literally sent me. What made me feel better about it was that I talked to another friend who submitted and she was like, yeah, I got the same email.
Right.
So they like just sent a map.
Generic. Yeah.
It's a generic fuck you.
It's a generic. How dare. Who told you to send this? It's like, we told you.
I'm sure they had like one slot for a female and it was taken. So we couldn't be the token diversity hire.
Man, it is. There is like, there is that feeling though. And you can divorce yourself from caring about it in the, you know, at some point in the process, but I'm telling you every, you know, if you do the work and you put the work in, you get invested. It's impossible not to.
And
it always feels bad when it doesn't go the way you want it to go.
It's like a miscarriage.
Well, like, you know, to your point about shows that came on at the wrong time.
Yeah.
The show that I helped create and the show that I ran, The Comedians on FX, mm-hmm. is, I think, a decent example of, like, it's actually kind of a show that maybe came on too late
in a way
because it was a mock documentary and it was about sort of the making of a television show behind the scenes and that kind of stuff. And by the time it came on the air, and it was a long road to get it on the air. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, so it was like
at the probably, time when you guys were
when the thing first came to us, we were like, this is amazing. And also just the idea of Billy Crystal playing a sort of version of Billy Crystal was very exciting. And
yeah.
the idea of working with him in general was very, so when that came on, and that's the weirdest feeling when something you do, you love it, and it's exactly what you were trying to do, you know, like, and you didn't just write it, you produced it, and you made it all like come to life, and it's like you watch it and you're like, this is the show that I meant to make, and then the audience just goes
the audience go meh?
Like, they were just kind of like, I mean, the audience didn't do anything, they just didn't watch it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that's a problem.
Yeah, there were just, I mean, you know, some people, it was, the numbers were okay, but it, what would have needed to happen for it to be a hit is that right. the audience would have had to grow.
You thought you had a beautiful baby, but and it turned out that people are like, your baby's okay.
I have a theory, though.
Your baby's never going to be more than 3 feet tall. I'm really sorry.
I know that.
Not that bad. Oh,
yeah. Poor baby. Your baby will always be a baby.
I know that networks like to cancel stuff and that don't do well, but I also think that the audience needs to see a few seasons to get it. Like, you're not going to like the first season because you're just getting acquainted to them.
I mean, unless John Landgraf, who runs FX, is the greatest actor of all time, it really, really killed him to cancel that show.
Because
he really did genuinely love it. And
then who?
It's, you know, there comes a point where between, you know, the ratings not being off the charts, the show cost a lot of money.
Because
we had, you know, fairly, for by FX standards, we had people who needed to get paid more than their that used to paying people
right,
in comedies
right.
and the critical reception was like B+ on a channel that has Louis winning every Emmy at the time. And you know
more.
What I mean? Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, right. like, or, you know, I'm saying like
yeah.
they're in the bit and, but now they have Atlanta winning every Emmy, you know? So it's like,
right.
that's their, like, if you're not going to be super cheap and if you're not going to get huge numbers, then you're damn well going to win Emmys, yeah. you know, and it's a bummer, but
yeah.
that's how it goes.
That is a bummer. FXX has one of my favorite shows right now.
Which one?
FXX, though. What's Baskets. Have you ever watched Baskets?
Yeah.
I fucking love that show.
My friend
I have
Brett.
An issue
Do you
with
know
it.
Brett Loudermilk?
No.
He's a sword swallower. He was on an episode.
Okay. I know the episode.
Yeah. Everybody was on it. And he was
is
like,
it the one with the guy
with
swallowing
the
swords? Swords?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the, yes, yeah. The freaks.
It's weird. That's all he does. He dropped out of high school when he was 16, and he's just been swallowing swords ever since.
Really? What more do you need to do, though, if you
how
can do that?
How much can you make a year swallowing?
He makes a lot. He makes more money than I do.
How much, per sword?
I know. There has to be a sword per sword
He gets,
price.
Like, flied out to Dubai to go to, like, some prince's house just to do, like, a show, and then gets flight, like, you know.
That's cool.
Huh. Yeah, it is really cool, but.
I mean, is he straight?
I gotta learn how to do that.
No, he's straight.
He's straight.
He's dating a really nice lady.
Okay. I was thinking, as a... I probably
oh don't, yeah, yeah yeah oh don't worry don't even we've heard it. This before yeah of course
but that would be amazing wouldn't it like
anyway back
guy,
to you
guy why are you putting the microphone that deep into your no, okay it's fine it's a good that it's good that it's a podcast
do you find that the was the comedians do, you don't that was like but you're proud of it right you
yeah it's the
you're not
the proudest I ever
you,
am
oh good
of anything I've ever done
and, oh wow
it was totally a great, like, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. It was amazing.
Do you think maybe, like, another network will save it, like
no.
we did with Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
No. Because that would have happened a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, it's...
it'll be a reboot. Now there's, like,
right,
reboots
exactly.
for everything.
Well, it was already a remake of a Swedish show, so yeah. it's like, you can't... Can you reboot a remake? Maybe. It's like, that's a lot of re...
They did that, I think, for a movie, but...
But, you know what, also, like... There's a point at which you really do just put things to rest.
You should. Yeah.
Okay. You definitely should.
I honestly don't think we should be rebooting everything like that. I think I don't think we should be rebooting all the
yeah.
the rebooting.
Yeah.
Too much rebooting. Yeah. Although I will say this, I don't know why this just popped into my head, but Jumanji. What if
I didn't see it.
It was really good. It was like a crazy good reboot.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Paddington 2.
I've heard that.
Actually. It was so good.
Paddington 2. I haven't seen Paddington 2.
You have to have at least one favorite Billy Crystal moment from the set or a story or something.
Well, there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
There are a lot.
Is he anything like you would think he is?
It depends on what you would think. Right. Well,
see, I'll tell you. I'll just be honest. Yeah. We could cut this if we need to. On a candid basis, I feel like I've heard he's kind of like one of those surly guys. Like
You get on his wrong side, and he can totally be a difficult, an unpleasant guy to deal with. Yeah. He and I did get into it on numerous occasions, and it's a very weird. Huh. I mean, I don't think he would mind. You know, I mean, like it is a very weird situation to find yourself in life when you basically learned this guy's routines word for word when you were an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
He's a big reason why you did what you did for a living, and you're kind of jawing with the guy and you're fighting with him. But it's part of the, it's like the creative, it's the creative process in some ways where you got two people feeling very strongly about something, and it always ended up in like a hug or by the time we had made the show, it was like, I mean, the guy means so much to me, and I respect and revere him so much. And it's so cool to be able to say that. And I text him, awesome. It's like this thing. It's like this amazing, wonderful. I was at his 70th birthday party last month. And,
oh my God.
And he mentioned me from the stage.
Wow.
It was like this amazing, it's like I leave my body every time that happens because it's one of my heroes.
Your 11-year-old self would be freaking out if you knew that this was happening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I literally wrote the whole last scene of the finale of that show is Josh talking about basically his 11-year-old self and how cool it is that I get to text Billy Crystal. And if the show, literally, the words are like, if the show gets canceled, can I still text you? You know what I mean? And then
well, the best writing canceled. Is the one that you from your life.
No, but it is this amazing thing.
That's so cool.
So yeah, it's totally weird. I would say probably one of the things that kept coming up is that you guys are probably too young to remember this, but he did this routine where he was like, he was Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali, Larry Holmes, Marvin Hagler, and, he played and so when I got myself through college by just performing that routine for my roommates, when we would have like a late night on set and you could see he was just kind of getting a little bit whatever, like a little over it, I would just start launching into it for him. Amazing. And he would just be like, it's so weird. So weird.
Did that happen?
But
you're doing his act.
Yeah. To him. Talk about stalking people, like way too cadence perfect.
Yeah.
To be cool.
Meta.
Yeah. And it was great.
Huh. And do you think he liked that or in a sense he hated it?
Yeah. Because you're basically, that's the ultimate, like, I couldn't be a, yeah, I'm a fan.
It's like me going to sing, one of Eddie Vedder's songs to him. And it's, like, wouldn't he be like,
I listened to this very interesting thing on NPR. They were talking about, like, covers that were bigger than the original.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, Dolly Parton's, like, I Will Always Love,
and
all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, Whitney Houston's was better and all that stuff. And they were saying how most of the time, they asked them, because you have to like pay and get consent to do that. Right. And they were like, yeah, most of the times the artists are flattered that someone's like, that's like the ultimate fandom, is someone repeating something you've done. Sometimes.
Yeah.
He said sometimes. And one of the big ones was like Elvis did like Hound Dog is not.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's
He didn't really write any of the songs. Right?
I know. So the guy who wrote Hound Dog was not, was kind of pissed. And yeah.
Well, Elvis stole from like famous black. Well, I guess they weren't famous back then, but from like the black community, black culture. He stole all of his songs. Yeah. Our last guest,
he's the Rachel Dozier.
Exactly. Our last guest was very upset about Frank Sinatra,
right,
not writing his own music and all that stuff. Same thing. Elvis is probably worse than Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
co-opted
Rihanna. She doesn't write her own shit either.
Well, these modern day ones, very few people write their own music nowadays or play for themselves, especially in the pop arena. Yeah.
What can you do?
I don't know why we got into pop music. Yeah. So is there, you said The Comedians obviously is one of your proudest works, right? Is there anything that you would say, what's your biggest failure when it comes to writing?
What do you wish you could erase from your IMDb?
Well, that's the best way to put it, because the answer becomes crystal clear.
That's why I don't have an IMDb account. I don't want people to know what I worked on.
right. Yeah, no, I've actually been trying to get this show erased from, and, well, not erased, but like for some reason, when you look me up, it's one of the first things that comes up. And I only worked on it for a brief period of time, like 18 years ago. You know, so it's like, it is not a significant moment in my career.
Tattoo, man.
But for some reason, it's like, but it's the tattoo. Why is it the tattoo on my face? Right. You know what I mean? Like
a dolphin.
Why?
The lower back tattoo.
It's remarkable. That you regret. No, but it was a show called Nikki, which was, you know, it was a bad show. I mean, it was a bad sitcom.
Did you know going in it was a bad show?
Yeah. Well, coming in, I kind of got hoodwinked a little bit, because Bruce Helford was the showrunner of Nikki, and he had also had...
Did he do anger management?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
My friend
and
was on that.
And at the time, he also had Norm and Drew Carey on the air. So the way it was kind of sold to me was you'd be coming in, and you'll meet with Bruce, and then you'll kind of like help out on this pilot for a couple of weeks, and then you'll go to work on the Drew Carey show. That was like kind of how it was sold to me. And then, you know, I did like 26 episodes of Nikki, and it was coming off of having done 25 episodes of King of Queens and having a weekend off in between, like literally like Friday to Monday. It was the year I got married, and it was like, but yes, so I knew it was a bad show, because it's like, the premise of the show was Nikki Cox is a showgirl, like going out to Vegas.
Yeah.
Not a stripper. We made very clear. Not a stripper, but a showgirl. And she meets a guy who's a high school wrestler who wants to go pro, which is a thing that wrestlers do, is they go from being high school wrestlers to pro wrestler. Like that's the job progression. You know, so like the premise of the show was so cynically conceived.
How did this get picked up in my sitcom?
Well, first of all, Bruce Helford was a huge
showrunner.
It was for the WB, which was a channel that, you know, doesn't exist anymore. But like, and they were going for an audience, I think, literally of 12 to 18-year-old boys.
Oh, yeah.
And what do 12 to 18-year-old boys like?
Showgirls.
Showgirls and pro wrestling. And so, like, but, you know, there were things like, you can't miss. But it was a multi-cam sitcom that depicted professional wrestling on a set the size of this room we're in. Oh, you know what I mean? So it was like, and I remember thinking, you know, pro wrestling is a thing that's on television. Like, people know what pro wrestling looks like when it's on television.
Right.
You can't do a sitcom version of it. It doesn't look like it was not a good show.
And it came off of, and that's coming from King of Queens, you said.
Yeah, which was a good show.
Which was wildly successful.
Yeah.
And you were on there for the whole run?
No, I was there for second season.
Just second season.
Yeah.
I applied to this
all of it.
This show once, like not once, like a couple weeks ago. And I got an email from the showrunner, a list of reasons why I don't want to be on the show.
Oh, that's nice. Wait, why? What? A list of reasons why you don't want to be on the show?
He was saying, oh, the show.
Trying to talk you out of it?
Basically.
Okay.
I think he sent it to everyone.
Okay.
Interesting.
And because it had a lot of flaws. And to the point where I was like sending it to my other friends being like, I don't want this job, right?
Really?
Like,
didn't he do that just to sort out the week in a sense?
That's how I would look at it. Yes, he said that once. I was like, I'm game because like I need money. But that's the only, honestly, it looks like a shitty show. And I feel like it's like when you're walking in knowing like this is going to be bad. Like,
but is it worth it just to have the credits or no?
Well, it all depends.
I would do it for money. But yeah.
No, I mean, you can't. I don't think there's a show bad enough that you can work on it and having worked on it is going to ruin your career.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think that is a thing where it's just like, oh, I'd love to hire this person, but look at that credit.
Yeah.
That's about
American Idol. No way. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that working, you know, you're not harming yourself by working on a bad show. What you are is I think there's just an opportunity cost a little bit associated with it, which is what else could you be doing with that time? And, you know, if you need money, you need money.
Right.
And that's why we do a lot of the things we do.
The one thing I worry about that, though, is just taking a job and then just develop, like, because if you're working with a showrunner who's not great, and then, like, maybe you develop a reputation and you're scared they'll say not good things about you to other showrunners. That's what I worry about as far as, like, how that can maybe harm you. But
I mean, I think that, to me, I think the antidote to that is just be the best person you can be and be the best,
be a good
hardest
person.
Worker and, you know, and like,
be easy to work with.
Yeah.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't be a dick, by the way, would have saved so many people.
I tell everyone that, that wants to be a writer.
Is that the best advice you can give to
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, it's it seems like such a no-brainer that you shouldn't even really need that advice.
Here's the thing,
but, that
I've learned a lot. A lot of meetings I've gone to, and I'll bring up someone that we know in common, and I hear this, oh, they're just so nice. Like,
right.
And people like will bring that up and light it up, and like they remember those people. So I think if it's more than just being not a dick, be a little
sure,
bit beyond that. Just be a good human. It's rare in Hollywood a little bit sometimes.
I will say in my experience, it's not as rare as.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's good.
Well,
I can
you're
say
a white
that.
Man.
No, it's that. Yeah, point taken. No, that's true. But like. In television and in comedy and, you know.
But yeah, people don't want to hire dicks.
In the same way that, like, honestly, getting that job on Forrest Gump was, like, an incredibly lucky break. And, like, who walks into their first job and mm-hmm. it winds up winning the Best Picture Oscar right. and giving you, like, 18 months of paying your rent.
Right.
You know, but also the people were stellar. You know
That's
what I mean?
Great.
Like the people were stellar there. And I worked for this woman, Ellen Lewis, who was the casting director, who I'm still friends with, who is one of the best casting directors in the business. And like you find that, and it was pure luck. I mean, it had nothing to do with, you know, like I'm sifting through all these jobs that I've got offers
right.
to. It was
I am
like,
the best
I fucking
casting
got
assistant.
Lucky.
Stepped in
yeah.
shit.
But so like it's mostly been lucky. And I think that most of the people who suck, we kind of part ways pretty quickly.
That's the thing. I think if you are a dick and not a nice person, not regardless of how talented you are, sometimes they're just so good that people are like, we have to
right.
get them. But if you're fine and you're a dick, no one wants to hire you. No one wants you in the writer's room.
Except for all the exceptions.
Of course.
We've heard a lot.
There's a lot of exceptions.
Yeah,
but is it being a dick or is it being a pain in the ass?
Yeah, it's a bit of both.
Well,
like just high maintenance.
It depends. I mean, obviously we've seen a ton of examples of terrible behavior that just, I don't personally understand how you get out of bed and you behave that way, mm-hmm. regardless of like the Hollywood of it all, but like get excused because people are perceived as having talent
or power, or they
have objectively made somebody a lot of money. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
what I don't get. Yeah.
No, I mean it's a thing.
So name like, some names, Ben. Come on.
No. I mean we know the names. They're all in the news.
Yeah.
It's like
news,
it's not
yeah.
like
now they're out. You're saying?
Yeah. And I'm to be honest, I don't. I'm racking my brain because like you know, I mean I never knew Harvey Weinstein or I never knew.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of these folks. You'd hear stories, you know, but I never, my paths never really crossed with any of
the
those.
The thing is, well, maybe the women community, they're pretty tight lately. And like, there's a ton of like Facebook message boards and stuff for like women comics and
right.
women writers and stuff. And they'll name names and be like, this guy's really hard to work with.
Yeah.
He is very, we don't say like, he won't sexually abuse you, but he'll like do things that'll make you feel very uncomfortable.
Right.
And like, and the women know, and they'll tell other women, and they'll,
right.
but like, unfortunately, that's all we have to mm-hmm. know. Like, we don't have anybody else.
Right.
And there's actually a lot of people still working out there that are not out yet. And it's kind of bothering a lot of women.
Sure.
Yeah. But anyway,
I'm sure the day will come. It feels like reckoning time is.
No,
is
they
upon,
won't. Like these people, they're too powerful.
I mean, wasn't Harvey Weinstein like the most powerful?
He was, but that was known. Like these people, these are smaller.
This is more
potatoes.
Secretive.
And they're just so powerful. They've done so many shows that people trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And until they die, they're just going to keep. Yeah, it's all right.
But they will die.
Yeah, they will.
I should. That came off so glib.
Like,
hey, no, it's fine, guys. They're all going to die.
It's crazy.
It's weird. They're mostly all these old white men. So
yeah, of course.
They will die eventually.
It's
yeah.
in power.
Yeah.
yeah.
So you're listed as consulting producer on Arrested Development.
Yeah, season 4.
Okay, so season 4.
Season
so what
four.
Is a consulting producer do?
Well, we were all consulting producers, except for Mitch, obviously, who ran the show.
Mm.
I think there may have been one or two folks who had, you know, like an EP title on
yeah.
it. Just basically because of it was early in the Netflix thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so the way they structured deals was like basically you get paid by the week and you get a consulting producer
oh,
credit.
Interesting.
Right.
But the easily the coolest thing about that was I had met with Mitch on season 1,
mm-hmm.
like when after I sat and watched the pilot and then walked and had this meeting and he wanted to hire me. And I couldn't take that job because I was under contract on another show.
Oh, wow.
And it was this, like, that was the thing that haunted me for 10 years, literally 10 years of my career was like, I could have worked on Arrested Development, and instead I had to keep working on this. I will not name, but other you know, other television show that was not as good as Arrested Development. And so when I heard that it was coming back, it was like, first of all, that doesn't happen. That wasn't a thing that happened at that moment in 2012 or whenever it was. So that was, that in and of itself was crazy. And then I was like, oh man, should I try to, should I like put my name in the hat? You know, like I could. And I kind of decided I wouldn't. And then I got a call from him, and it was like, oh my God. Like, and then we sat, and then he said, well, come on. And he hired me. And then I came in for my first day of work, and the people who had already been working there were like, oh man, Mitch has been talking about how like you were the one who got away. And I'm I'm like, it really happened. like it wasn't just something that I,
in my mind,
I was like, for a while, I was like, is this just a story I've been telling myself? Literally like this can't be real. This can't be real. I must be making this up. So to get confirmation that it was real was super cool. And he's one of the funniest men on the planet. I love that show so much.
And then, so season four was a little bit different. Some of the fans had issues with, but then they've announced recently, I liked it myself.
Yeah.
They announced recently though, they're going to do like a recut. Did you hear about
that? Yeah, I did hear about
that.
I read about it.
Are your feelings, your thoughts about that?
Well, no, I mean, I think Mitch should and can and ought to do whatever he wants with that show because it's his show and it's special. And if somebody's going to let him do it, then he should do it. So, I mean, it was definitely a ambitious thing to try to do, to, you know, to try to structure a season the way he structured it.
Around each character specific, like each character had their own episode.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that was driven by the fact that actors scheduling was a real big challenge and getting, we literally couldn't get, you know, to Jason Bateman, Will Arnett in the room necessarily, you know, for that many scenes. So you couldn't get all eight or all nine or seven of them, nine, I think, you know, in the room all day, every day, the way you could in the old days of the show. So that was how that sort of drove a little bit that creative choice. Mm-hmm. But the best was, and this is 100% true, and I have a picture on my phone to prove it, is like, the writer's rooms were covered with index cards. Like I'm arranging my hand. So it was like 360 around every wall, you know, like floor to ceiling, into another room. There was actual yarn connecting some of the,
it's like a CSI.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And it was hilarious. He put so much thought into that. And honestly, I only worked there for a little while, but it was such a pleasure to watch him work. He's so freaking funny.
That is so cool. Because you think about that actually when you're watching season four, like how do they keep the ties together?
Right.
They literally are doing like a...
There was a very beautiful mind thing going on with like a 5D Rubik's Cube.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. It was nutty.
Is there anything specifically you're most proud of writing?
Well, you know, other than The Comedians for Television, right? Which is, I'd say far and away my creative and like professional highlight in terms of the jobs that I've had.
Right.
I actually did just write a movie script that I think is the best thing I've ever written.
Really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And it's sci-fi.
No. That's
a job.
That's a little kernel in my head.
Did
but
you
I'm trying to think about it and have that jawbone write it for me.
Did you always want to do features?
Yeah. When I started out, I definitely always wanted to do features. So I've kind of like been chasing that.
I've been so scared to do features, and right now I'm writing one, but it's like a scary process.
They're hard. Yeah. That's a lot. It's a lot of story.
If you're under the mentality of television for so long, it's like a different beast.
Yeah.
So
they're both so great in different ways, but sometimes when if you've been working on a feature or features for a while, going back to like writing a 30-page comedy pilot is just delightful. It's like, oh, this scene doesn't work, I'll throw it out and give you a new one. It's like, there's nothing. Oh God, that sounds great. Yeah.
So here's a non-writer question. Yeah. When you say a movie's done, how many times have you written it? How many drafts have you gone through?
That's a tough question.
It's not the first only draft, because
no, it's not
there's
the
networks
draft.
And studio notes and all that stuff.
I think done for me and maybe the shorthand when I say it, I probably mean I was ready to show it to somebody.
And that's what my next question was going to be. So then you show it to somebody, they read it, they say, yes, this is...
Well, or no, but, you know, I mean, if there's a generally speaking, there's a point at which it's time to make a decision. Are we going to, is somebody going to move forward with this one way or the other? And then when that happens, there are inevitably rewrites, and you make, you know, adjustments based on whatever it is, the actors or studios or whatever, you know, and then, so you're never done with it.
I mean,
you're
a piece of art.
In the editing room, you're still totally making very significant choices, but yeah, I don't know. Like when I'm ready to show a script to somebody, that's kind of a meaningful thing, because I'm very, very tough on my writing, and I'm extremely afraid of self-embarrassment. So I'm just like, I don't want to show. So if there are problems that I know about, I just won't show it until I fix those problems.
I have a question about that. So when you are done with a script, I know a lot of people that I work with and myself probably have this question. Who do you feel is the person you show it to first?
It totally depends on the
Is it
totally depends on
someone safe? Is it a writer?
Yeah,
is it someone who's not a writer?
Just it depends. Like, I mean, this script in that I'm referencing now, this feature script, first people I showed it to were totally safe people.
Right.
Who I kind of knew.
And who do you consider safe people?
Well, I mean, one was my friend Laura, who was a staff writer on The Comedian, who I like a lot, and who's great, and who always has good ideas, and I just trust. You know what I mean? Like, And actually, the other is my friend Robin, who was my assistant on The Comedians, but isn't anymore. So she's not like beholden to say, this is good. Like she does. It's not like she's.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't want to show it to someone.
I don't want to. Yeah. Like if you show it to someone who works for you, then you have to always take that with a grain of salt.
I'm always scared to show it to someone who like possibly could hire me one day. Cause it's like, I don't want them to think that this is a reflection of me totally. And I can't grow. And
that's a very valid fear.
Yeah.
And seriously.
And
it is.
I have like imposter syndrome where I'm just like, I don't belong here. I'm not good enough for this. And so I'm always hesitant to send it to anyone.
Sure.
That's interesting to hear who you think is.
So I do think
person.
you do have to like, a little bit, work it up a ladder a little bit, you know, is just
don't give it to an exec at the first job.
I mean, it is definitely, it's a good rule of thumb to think of it as anytime you're asking somebody to read kind of anything you've written or watch anything you've made or anything, they are potentially making a final judgment on you. You know what I'm saying? Right. Not just a judgment on you, but what's that?
We're also biased because they're your friends and they want to support
whoever
you.
Whoever it is, I'm saying like if it's your friend, then they're obviously not going to say I don't like you anymore because your script was imperfect.
Yeah.
But yeah, anybody else, if it's somebody who certainly if it's somebody who's being introduced to you, to your work, then you could you definitely want to get as much confirmation that it is as good as you can get it.
Yeah.
Right. And also hopefully when you show it to people, they can actually help you make it a little better.
Right.
Even if that's just finding typos, but you know, obviously up from there is asking questions where it's just like, oh shit, I actually hadn't considered that.
Right. Right. I think also there's something special. I talked to someone who was like, I like seeing it before it's even at its final stage. Cause then it's like, I can give them some advice to how to make it better, and then they really develop something great. And you know, anyway, so that's interesting.
I'm interested
to hear about that.
I agree. All right, one more question for you, Ben. Do you have a favorite charity?
Oh boy. Well, you know,
everyone trips up on this.
No, I do. I mean, whenever I am asked that, I say the Christopher Reeve Foundation for Paralysis, because I have a very close cousin who had a spinal cord injury, and so I've raised some money for them over the years. These days, I think maybe I'm a little bit torn between that and social causes that will sort of help fight this shit show of a world we seem to be living in.
You're voting Tuesday.
Well, in the short term, what we'll do is we'll give a $100 donation in your name to the Christopher Reeve Foundation.
So sweet.
Thank you so much for that. Because it's too hard to get Trump out.
I know.
I can't, not with $100. Like,
swing left, guys.
There you go. Yeah. Blue wave. You are at MR, Mr. Ben Wexler, on Twitter.
Yeah, Ben Wexler was taken, I guess. So. And I want
that guy that plays for the Blue Jays or whatever.
Exactly.
The third string goalie. Jeez. Man, if I could beat him out next year, how sweet would that be?
That would be amazing.
It'd be amazing because I've never donned a goalie pad.
You could add another thing to the pamphlet.
Also, I don't skate.
Athletics.
Listen, if Ben Wexler can do it, Ben Wexler.
Thank you for believing in me.
Opinion,
thank you.
Thank you so much for being
You're
here.
You're the first person
episode.
Who ever believed in me, hockey-wise.
Thank
Thanks
you,
so
everybody,
much, everyone.
For listening to Fail It Up. Have a great, great night. Great day. Thank you so much.
It's your choice what time of day you listen to this.